Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for your attendance on this cold winter's morning. Eugene is particularly well qualified to undertake this, what is now a combined task. He practices extensively in employment and industrial law, as well as general administrative law. He's appeared in inquiries, including the Royal Commission into the Building and Construction Industry, and he has also acted as an arbitrator and mediator, particularly in the field of employment and industrial relations, but he has conducted mediations outside that area, including in property and organisational restructuring matters. He was, before coming to the bar, a solicitor and partner in a Melbourne law firm which specialised in administrative, industrial, employment and superannuation law, and in related areas, and he appeared and instructed counsel in federal and state superior courts and relevant tribunals. He's been an associate to a judge of the federal court, and before that an employee solicitor in South Australia. He's at present the president of the Victorian Bar Industrial Bar Association. So he's, as I said, preeminently qualified to deal with this current and topic, which is really of ever-present interest to those who are concerned with rights and obligations under employment law, particularly as it affects the majority of employees in this country who are covered by the Fair Work Act of 2009. So that's enough introduction from me. I'll ask Eugene to present the first part of his discussion on the sources and content of national employment standards. Thank you, Eugene.
Yeah, thank you, Don. Next time I'm going to organise more substitute fielders, but that's all right. The first part of the talk is really to give an overview as to what provisions the Act makes about minimum conditions which employees are entitled to and which employers are obliged to comply with. But a very brief comment first about the Fair Work Act itself. Following on from work choices legislation, the Fair Work Act, now to an extent greater than work choices, relies primarily on the corporation's power of the Commonwealth. There are still some other constitutional powers relied on. And so when we talk about employees and employers, we're talking about national system employees or national system employers who are employees or employers essentially employed by constitutional corporations. There are some extensions to that. In addition to employees employed by constitutional corporations, a number of states, particularly relevant here, Victoria, have passed referral legislation. And so, to a very large extent, a lot of public sector employees in Victoria are also covered by this Act. So, when we're talking about employees, we're not talking about all employees, although I must say the overwhelming majority of employees are covered. Now, the Act itself makes, well, not itself, the Act makes a range of provisions for employment regulation. But I suppose it's true to say that the primary focus on the Act is for employees and employers to make agreements. But underpinning all those agreements, there are a range of minimum standards. They can be characterised in a number of ways. They are, first of all, standards which apply to all national system employees, and then thereafter there are particular provisions which apply to different categories or types of employees. The talk this morning will be principally concentrating on the national employment standards which are provided for in the Act. There are other minimum standards, as I say, which the Commission can make by way of workplace determinations or minimum wage orders, but these are really in relation to particular groups. In addition to the national employment standards, which are, I think, 10 standards legislated for and set out in the Act, the Act also provides for a raft of modern awards. The award system has been significantly changed under this legislation. Prior to this legislation, unions were generally parties to the awards. Under this legislation, people are covered by awards, but there's no particular party. The modern award provisions of the Act has been implemented. It was a difficult job for the Commission, or then Fair Work Australia, to do. The request given by the then Minister was that in making modern awards, the Commission should not disadvantage any employees or impose any extra burden on employers, but at the same time to rationalise thousands of awards into modern awards which would apply to particular industries. However difficult that was, the Commission, or Fair Work Australia, has now done that. And so in terms of looking, when you have a problem for employees or employers as to what minimum entitlements might be relevant, a good starting point is to go to the modern award list on the Commission website and pick out an industry which is relevant. If all else fails and you can't find a modern award which applies and you've rung the Fair Work Ombudsman and they can't help you, there's a miscellaneous modern award which tries to sweep up everyone else. But principally this talk will be really concentrating on the national employment standards, at least in the first part, as the minima which apply. The modern awards from industry to industry differ to a certain extent, but concentration will be on the NES. Now, as I said before, the NES is a good place to start. Modern awards, whilst they might be able to deal with matters otherwise dealt with in the NES, are not permitted to derogate from them. The NES are a list of 10 employment conditions which are set out in the Act. The NES apply generally to all full-time or part-time employees, but only certain of them apply to casual employees. We'll go through them in a little bit more detail, but the NES entitlements which apply to casual employees relate to carer's leave, compassionate leave, maximum weekly hours, community service leave, except jury service, a right to seek a day off on a public holiday, and the provision of a Fair Work statement. I don't, as I go through, make a distinction between casual and permanent employees, but bear in mind when you're advising someone that their status as a casual or permanent might well impact on what entitlements they have. The National Employment Standards came into effect on 1 January 2010. So, just because it's easier maybe, I don't intend to deal with the source of employment obligations prior to 1 January 2010, but really look at what the current situation is. So, and I deal first of all with, I'll just go run through the list and make some brief comments about each of them as we go through. The first of first in the list by Section 61 of the Act, provision is made for maximum weekly hours of work. So that I think is 38 hours a week for a full-time employee. Now, there is provision for the ability to employers to request additional hours to be worked. As a general comment, to some extent, some of the national employment standards contain provisions which will require courts to look at what is reasonable in all the circumstances. Historically, I suppose, questions of hours and overtime and the like have been the preserve of the industrial tribunals. But when we get to consider enforcement provisions, in terms of whether or not an employer, for example, is in breach by requesting hours which are additional hours which are unreasonable, the courts then have to make up or exercise a discretion about a range of things. Those include, obviously, risks, if any, to health and safety, the employee's personal circumstances, including family responsibilities, the needs of the business, whether by working the additional hours the employee is entitled to receive any additional remuneration by overtime or penalty rates, what notice has been given by each of the employer for the request and for the employee for his or her refusal in the event that they do refuse, patterns of work in the industry, level of employees' role or responsibilities within the business, and whether any request is consistent with another ability that the NES preserves in respect of hours of work, and that is the capacity to average hours over a period of time. Employees and employers are able to average hours out over a period of time, but that's not irrelevant to the question of whether or not the request for additional hours are reasonable. If the average hours over a four-week period, for example, are 38 hours a week, but worked in 1 week 5 hours and picked up significantly in the second week, then that may be unreasonable. So, first of all, hours of work, which is fairly fundamental, I suppose, to most employment arrangements. Now, the second standard is an ability in employees who are parents or have responsibility for the care of a child to request a change in the working arrangements, also request flexible working arrangements. Now, I think at the moment that right to request exists only for parents or persons with responsibility for the care of a child. I think there was contemplated legislation to extend the right to request to older employees, but I don't think that's gone through. Now, this is only a means, a provision by which a request can be made. The obligations on the employer include an obligation to consider it reasonably and to give a written response. So, once again, if one was to enforce an alleged contravention or bring an alleged contravention to court, once again, the courts would be required to exercise their discretion into whether or not the request was reasonable, whether or not there were proper grounds, whether it was properly considered, and if refused, whether there were good and proper grounds for the refusal. Once again, fairly basic things are relevant to the question of whether there are proper grounds for refusal, including the effect on a worker's on the workplace, the effect on the business, the ability to organise other staff to cater for the flexible hours, the ability to recruit replacement employees if the flexibility requested resulted in a permanent change to the hours worked. So it's not a bad thing, but ultimately, I think ultimately there will be not a flurry of cases in courts about breaches of that one. Parental leave and related entitlements is the next standard. This applies in part and only in limited part to casual employees, but they're fairly standard provisions, and I suspect everyone is fairly familiar with general parental leave provisions. There is now an ability, if you qualify, for 12 months leave. Once again, there are a range of specific rules which apply, including the timing of the request and the time at which leave can commence. For a pregnant employee, leave can commence 6 weeks before the expected date of birth. There's specific provision made for couples, each of whom are employees. Each of them are entitled to 12 months unpaid parental leave, or together no more than 24 months. There's capacity for extension, and once again, you get back to refusal or otherwise on reasonable business grounds and obligation on employers to consider. One of the things which quite often, in my experience, bedevil parental leave is that people on leave are quite often rung up or contacted by their employers because there's changeovers or handovers that need to be done. The NES makes specific provision for that. They call them keeping in touch days, although it's under the, Paid Parental Leave Act. And there's provision that handover keeping in touch days can occur. One of the problems in a practical sense is that it's not unusual, I think, it's probably fair to say, that a lot of women, particularly who go on parental leave, like to keep in touch. They are probably well advised to keep in touch. There is probably a disproportionate number of restructurings which occur when people are on parental leave than for other reasons, but in any event, there is now provision for employees and employers to keep a bit of a handle on what's happening at the workplace and keeping informed. The next standard is the an entitlement to annual leave. There's no great magic in any of this. The entitlement is to 4 weeks annual leave unless you're a shift worker. And a shift worker is those who work in an enterprise with 24-hour working patterns or 7 days a week. And if you're regularly rostered to work shifts and regularly work on Saturdays and Sundays, then you're entitled to 5 weeks annual leave. There is a capacity in employers to direct employees to take annual leave at a particular time. And once again, that request can only be made if reasonable, and once again, a lot of the criteria to determine the reasonableness or otherwise are fairly sensible. Employers generally don't like employees accruing excessive amounts of leave, and so that may be a good reason to request or direct an employee to take leave. Employers quite often have shutdown periods. They may work in an industry which has established custom and practice. There can be any number of factors which would be reasonable, which would make the request to take leave at a particular time reasonable. Subject to that, leave can accumulate, and generally speaking, an employee has the choice as to when that leave is taken. One of the things that the NES establishes, and in circumstances where payments are required, needs to be borne in mind, is the distinction between the base rate of pay and the real rate of pay. A lot of the entitlements to employees, or the obligations of employees, particularly in relation to leave, is to pay their base rate of pay, and base rate of pay separately defined in the Act, and that excludes loadings, bonuses, and things of that nature. There is also a capacity to cash leave out, subject to conditions, one of which is that there needs to be kept at least 4 weeks in hand, I suppose. Personal and carer's leave, I suspect most people are familiar with that. There's 10 days of that. There is a provision for a couple of days of unpaid carer's leave and a couple of days of compassionate leave. Once again, these periods of absence are payable on the base, an employee's base rate of pay. There is additional to that leave, seems to be all of these NESs are about leave, but that's all right, that's good. Additional types of leave are voluntary emergency management activity, it's generally called community service leave, and it contemplates essentially two types of leave. First of all, the voluntary emergency management, as well as jury duty. There is no specific limitation in the number of days for emergency management. In relation to jury duty, an employer is obliged to pay the base rate of pay for 10 days, so try not to get onto a really long trial, I suppose. Long service leave is is a little more complex, I suppose, in that there are provisions which existed before under a range of different types of industrial instrument which still apply. That will require, when advising an employer or employees to what entitlements or obligations, to go back and search out those instruments, because the NES doesn't specifically provide any length of entitlement or length of service to get the entitlement, and modern awards cannot include terms dealing with long service leave. So the best I can say to you this morning is, you've got to work out whether or not there's an industrial instrument which existed prior to 1 January 2010 which provided for long service leave, and then if not, go to the relevant State Long Service Leave Act. Public holidays are beauties. They're provided for, a list of the public holidays. There is, once again, capacity in employees and employers to request work to be performed on public holidays, and the right to request and the right to refuse is subject to the notions of reasonableness I've discussed before. I won't go into the notice provisions for notice for termination of employment or redundancy provisions, but can I tell you that you should look at section 117 and following of the Act. There are gradations of notice of termination required, ranging from 1 week notice of termination for an employee of less than 1 year, and 4 weeks for employees for more than 5 years, and severance pay ranging from 4 weeks to an employee of less than 1 year service up to, 12 weeks if they've got at least 10 years service. Uh, And just in case employees and employees don't know about these things, the last NES is that there is an obligation imposed on the on employers to give a Fair Work information statement to each new employee. That's available on the Fair Work Ombudsman website. I've got one copy here if anyone wants to have a look at that at a later on. It, I suppose, is fairly general information. Now, all of those NES standards can't be contracted out from. Modern awards, which deal in particular industries, should not derogate from them. All that being said, there's no limitation on employers and employees agreeing to pay in excess of them, but just thinking of the minimum standards, the legislation is in effect in Victoria for employees of corporations and for most public servants, although it's probably irrelevant for public servants. They're covered by the NES and I think covered by modern awards. I know at the time, I won't go into modern awards at the moment other than to say that you've got to look at the list and see which one is applicable. I should also say this, that under previous industrial regimes, you know, applications could be made to vary awards. There is an inbuilt mechanism now in the Act which requires the Commission to review modern awards. It's already conducted a first review, albeit not a review in full. There's a four-year review which is coming up that doesn't assist, I think, in terms of individual employees or employers, although there is now a statement out as to the process of that, and if anyone represents an employer that wants to make a particular submission, then you better get onto the Fair Work Commission website and look at the timelines. So we're now acting under an Act largely relying on the corporation's power that sets a floor. The floor is the NES. The Commission has made modern awards, and thereafter employees and employers are entitled to make agreements. I think that's probably a fair introduction, Don, and I see the time.
Yes, thank you for that overview, Eugene, of the sources and content of the minimum standards which apply, as Eugene has pointed out, to all employees of constitutional corporations and to a large body of employees in the state of Victoria.